You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of men on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness. We will keep in mind and remember that you and I have the ability and the dignity and the right to make our own decisions and determine our own destiny.
Your world, your country, your community, and you. Let's talk about it now on The Neil Larson Show with co-host Julie Mason.
And good morning on this Friday morning, this historic day. Of course, today marks 50 years since the catastrophic failure of the Teton Dam. And Julie, we're going to spend this entire hour with someone who's written a book about this. He is a dam safety engineer, and Dr. Nathaniel Gee joins us today in studio, the author of Failure and Fortitude, How Faith, Politics, and Power Shaped the Teton Dam Disaster. Nathaniel, welcome. It's good to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, first of all, introduce yourself. You have some roots in this region, and you understand the culture of Rexburg very, very well. I don't know if you were old enough to be alive when that happened, but you look like you're maybe around our age, but you know all about it.
Yeah, so I was not alive when it happened, and if it had happened 12 hours earlier, I probably would have never been alive. My dad spent the night in a basement that would soon be flooded with 6 feet of water and mud. And like many people, had it happened 12 hours earlier, it would have been a very different story, as there would have been hundreds, if not thousands, of lives lost. And so, you know, I have family that were here, a lot of family in the Sugar City, Rexburg area at the time. And so, yeah, very familiar with it, heard stories about it growing up. You know, this dam that broke, didn't really always pay that much attention as a young kid at reunions, but people would talk about it from time to time. And then as I got older, got a job at the Bureau of Reclamation doing dam safety work. And at Reclamation, Teton is the reason the dam safety program exists. Really, it changed dam safety across the country for everyone who's involved in dams, but particularly Reclamation. You know, it brought about the Reclamation Dam Safety Law. And so my very job was based on this dam. And that's really when I thought, well, maybe I should look into those stories I always heard about as a kid and understand it a little bit more. And so started doing some really deep diving into it.
So you kind of became a quasi-historian then of the Teton Dam flood and failure, even though you weren't around for it.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I realized there were different people who told different parts of the story, but no one really connected all the dots. There's a really great book out there called That Day in June, where you have these oral histories, great oral histories from people here in Rexburg and Sugar City who lived through it. I got that book, loved it. And then at work, I would see the technical side, right? Large 1,000-page volumes on the bookshelf, The Failure of Teton Dam, where they technically break down what went wrong from a scientific and physics aspect. But really no connection between the two. And then a lot of the story that's missing is, yeah, technically it failed this way. Well, why did they design it that way in the first place? And why did they decide to have a dam in the first place? And why was this area looking for a dam? You know, a lot of the stories that really connect all those dots had never been told, and I couldn't find it. You know, I was looking for a book like that as I started to dive deeper, and I said, well, guess I got to jump in there and write it. And it was really in 2016 that I decided I'm going to do this project. And I thought, oh, I'll have it out well before the 50th. But I barely made it.
You got it. So it's published. And if people go to NathanielKGee.com, they can read all about it too.
Yep. It's there. It's on Amazon. It's carried at bookstores, Desert Book, Barnes & Noble, different bookstores have it.
Well, let's start chronologically. Why was this dam built? I mean, that's where you started, right? Figuring out why was the need? Why'd they choose that area? Why was it built?
So as you look at the 1960s, every politician wanted a dam in their district. Dams were the ultimate feather in your cap because they brought so many benefits, whether it was flood control, water supply, irrigation, recreation, you know, all these things we looked at. And Idaho was no different. In fact, even as early in the 50s, Hamer Budge tried really hard to get a dam in this district, but he was actually looking at Burns Creek Dam, and he couldn't get it passed. And Ralph Harding, a young up-and-coming politician in 1960, said, I am going to run against Hamer. And Hamer was a popular incumbent, and so he thought, how do I beat him? And there were two things he really hammered Hamer on, and that was, one, I will be able to get a dam in this district. He hasn't been successful, and the reason he's not been successful is he's not voting for everyone else's dams. He's saying, I need a dam, but then he goes out and votes against everybody else's. He said, I'll work along to get along. I will get us a dam. The second thing is, it turns out, which is very unique to this area, is everyone knows a lot of the voting group are members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And Hamer, one Sunday, did not let his home teacher in. And somehow that made a Washington byline.
Wow. Of course it would.
Yeah. And Ralph Harding took that Washington byline and made a copy for every member in the district and sent it out. And it was very effective. And he won the election in 1960. And he went to work trying to get a dam for this district. And he first tried Burns Creek Dam, but had no traction. He found out that it was harder than he thought. And that's when he started to look to Teton Dam. Teton Dam had been looked at by the Bureau of Reclamation. They had done some early studies, but they had always said the geology is really poor in this area. It's not the best place for a dam. But the more he looked into it, he knew that it was popular with the locals. He had support from Frank Church in the Senate. And so he decided he was going to start moving towards Teton. But even that took a back seat for a little while until 1964. In 1964, he was not sure whether he would run again because he was on the ropes politically. So bad so that he didn't think he had a chance to win. And the reason was because he got in a political fight with Ezra Taft Benson.
The Mormon angle again. Here we go.
Yeah. Right. That could be worse than not letting the home teachers in.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. He went on the floor of Congress. And if you read the speech, it's a very interesting speech. You're like, why is he saying this on the floor of Congress? You know, he gets out and says, I know the church is true, but the church has to put control on Ezra Taft Benson, right? He was very outspoken, involved in the John Birch Society. And needless to say, members in the district, why they were mostly Democrat, they did not like him going out and talking about Ezra Taft Benson that way. And he really dug in and started saying, well, I've got letters from high people in the church who agree with me. And he eventually produced some of these letters. One of them was David O. McKay's son, Robert McKay, had written a letter saying, yeah, I agree with you about Ezra Taft Benson. He probably shouldn't talk so much, you know.
Yeah.
But then that put Robert McKay in a weird spot. And he said, no, I support Ezra Taft Benson. That letter's out of context. And so all of this led to him thinking he couldn't win re-election. But that's when he decided, you know what, if I cash all my political chips, maybe I can get this dam authorized. And if I get the dam authorized before the 1964 election, I might save my chances. And he does. He goes to work like crazy to get Teton Dam authorized and make sure he puts it to the front burner. It was kind of on the back burner at Reclamation. They weren't sure because of the geology, but he gets it moving. And sure enough, September 7th, 1964, they authorized Teton Dam. But what's really important is when you get something like that, you want to make a big deal of it, right? So he plans this big float trip. It's a common political thing at the time. Let's do a float trip. And he invites Secretary of Interior Stuart Udall. And the other person he invites, which is really important, is Mike Kirwan. Now, Mike Kirwan's a congressman, not from Idaho. But he's really important because he is over the money. He's over appropriations. He decides which authorizations actually come out of committee and can actually get money. Very important official. And he says something at the end of that float trip at the press conference. He says, listen, voters, if you will vote for Ralph Harding next year in 1965, I will fund the Teton Dam. If you do not, it could be 30 years before you ever see this project funded.
Wow.
Quid pro quo. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
And the district is very upset about it. You know, they start writing in, why is he blackmailing us? Ralph Harding plays this weird game where he's like, well, yeah, he probably shouldn't have said that, but, you know, that's the way Washington works, so you better vote for me, you know?
Wow.
My hands aren't dirty.
Yeah. And so 1964 is a very interesting election. If you look at it, Democrats sweep across the country in 1964, but not in this district. Ralph Harding loses in this district, a lot of crossover voting, and Mike Kirwan is true to his word. He will not fund Teton Dam. In fact, Ralph Harding, I was visiting with someone yesterday, and I found another article that shows Ralph Harding went to D.C. even after he lost to try to get Mike Kirwan to fund the Teton Dam, and he wouldn't do it. But of course, Teton Dam does exist, or did exist for a short time. And the reason is because in 1971, Mike Kirwan dies.
Oh.
And we get a new appropriations committee. He's in the Congress till the day he dies. But when he's replaced, the very next year, they put in funding for Teton Dam, and it begins construction in 1972.
Okay.
That's a great breaking point. We are going to take a break, but we'll continue again. The book is called Failure and Fortitude: How Faith, Politics, and Power Shaped the Teton Dam Disaster. And you can find it on Amazon. You can also go to Nathaniel's website, nathanielkgee.com. We'll be back. I can't wait to hear more of this story when we return right here on this special edition of the Neil Larson Show on this 50th anniversary of the Teton Dam disaster on News Talk 107.9. And we're back on this Friday morning on News Talk 107.9. Nathaniel K. Gee is our guest. He's the author of Failure and Fortitude: How Faith, Politics, and Power Shaped the Teton Dam Disaster. And Julie, fascinating, by the way. I just have to give you some kudos for your storytelling ability. It's fascinating to hear the backstory. I didn't know any of that. And I love to follow politics, but it is fascinating how that came to be. And anyway,
so we left off. The dam has just been given the money to be built. So you are a dam safety engineer. Were they aware that this probably wasn't the best place? Like, what was the warning signs?
Well, in 1969, while they're waiting for funding, they go ahead and do some pilot grout holes. Now, in a dam, ideally, you're putting a dam on nice, solid bedrock. But that's not always going to happen. There's times that bedrock is too far down that you're going to have some fractured rock above it. Well, what you often do in that case is you grout it. Basically, you drill holes trying to capture, you hope to intersect all those cracks, and then you pump it with very runny cement, essentially grout, and you just keep pumping it until you can fill as much of those voids as you can. So then in 1969, they drilled some holes, and they knew it was pretty fractured. So they thought, you know, given how many tests holes we're doing, we're thinking 250,000 cubic feet of grout for this area. They didn't get to half the holes, and they used over twice the amount of grout that they had planned.
Okay.
The voids were so much larger than they thought. The cracking was so much more than they thought. So they knew this is pretty bad geology for us to work with. And they had a few things that were really putting them in a tight spot. Between when it got authorized and when it got funded, there was a very large oil spill off the coast of California. And that led to the passing of the wonderful NEPA law, National Environmental Protection Act, right, in 1970. And that act said you had to look at the impacts. And because of that, there was a lot of people putting pressure on them environmentally. We've got to look at Teton Dam. But they knew that they couldn't increase the cost very much because they needed a good benefit cost ratio.
Mm.
You need it to be a viable project.
Yeah.
And so they knew there was all this environmental pressure, and yet the initial benefit cost ratio wasn't that much above one. And so if we start increasing costs, we could make this project not viable. So they have, we can't increase cost. We know we need more grout. We've got to come up with something. And they decide to come up with a new design they had never done before. And that is, we will cut 70 feet into this really bad rock, but just narrowly, just a nice narrow cut so we don't have to remove too much rock. And we'll just compact it with silt material, actual core material from the dam. And that'll protect the water from getting through. They'd never done it before. And ultimately, that becomes the demise of Teton Dam, is that decision to try this new design. Because of it was new, they didn't put into the specs a lot of important pieces. And that ultimately leads to they didn't seal the cracks as well upstream and downstream of the trench. In fact, the contractor stops putting any concrete into the cracks about halfway up because they didn't put it in the specs. They're like, we don't know exactly how to do it. We've never done it, so we're not going to put it in the spec. They'll figure it out. Well, didn't work out.
Well, obviously it didn't. And go ahead.
I was going to pause the story because I think we should keep moving chronologically because, of course, you have stories about the damage and the victims and everything. But have they, I mean, it takes time and studies to figure out why it failed. Do we have other dams across the United States that were built similar to this dam?
So the simple answer is Teton taught us a lot. And one of the things is the importance of always protecting your core material with a filter. And what that means is water is going to move through your dam. If you see any embankment out in the world, water gets through that. It's not perfectly impermeable.
Yeah.
But... sorry, just a second. But if you move water, that's okay as long as you're not moving material with it.
If it's compromising just water, the structure. Yes.
Yeah.
Got it.
Exactly. And so that was the problem with Teton is if you filter that material, if you put other material next to it that can keep the little particles from moving, essentially a good filter. Think of it as a strainer for your spaghetti, right?
Yeah.
You want the water to go through and not the spaghetti. You want the water to go through, not the dam. And that's what they didn't do. They didn't protect it with a filter. And after Teton, they went through and added filter berms on a lot of dams. Mm. I will say Teton was unique in the key trench design. So you'll see filter berms added on the downstream of dams after Teton. We still, to this day, we're always looking at filter compatibility at dams and looking at do we need to add a filter layer, filter berm. But I have not seen a dam with a key trench design like Teton. That was unique, and that was something that, one and done design, I think, is what we would call that one.
So going back to some of the comments you said earlier, the Teton Dam breaks June 5th, 1976. After that, was there kind of a hiatus of dam building until they could say, well, we got to stop, make sure what we know caused this to fail and make sure we aren't making the same mistakes in other dam projects around the country?
Yeah, a lot of things came together at Teton. You have this big dam building boom in the United States from about, I would say, Hoover's the big thing that drives it, right? Hoover becomes the great PR campaign for dams. And it goes all the way to about Teton. Right around the 70s, a few things come together. People are starting to be aware that dams pose risk to people. Teton really highlights that. Buffalo Creek in 72. But really, Teton, right after Teton, we have back-to-back failures. Teton fails. The next year, Laurel Run fails in Pennsylvania, killing 40. Mm. That same year, Kelly Barnes Dam fails, killing 39. Also, it's actually a small Bible college. Small dam, not very much water. But a lot, it happens at midnight instead of noon. The parallels between it and Teton are very interesting.
Yeah.
But it's in Georgia, and Jimmy Carter's president. So that has impact, too. His wife flies from church to be there as they're removing bodies, some of these kids'
He owes
bodies.
It to his people to put a stop to this.
Yeah. So there is a big movement to say, hey, dams may not be as safe. There's also a big uptick in environmental pressures in the 70s, right? Environmental movement starting. And all that. And also fiscal conservatism. Jimmy Carter really feels like we're spending too much in the Army Corps of Engineers and Reclamation on these big projects, and they probably aren't penciling. So he actually puts out what he calls his hit list. It's dam projects that he wants to put an end to. And so those three things combining really slows down the dam building boom, and it never really picks back up. It comes off. They stop a lot of dams that started building. Auburn Dam in California, Columbia Dam in Tennessee. These large dam projects that had spent millions of dollars get stopped. Not only stalled, but stopped, get completely stopped after Teton.
Yeah. A question I have, because as you probably know, with our water situation here in East Idaho, there's been a resurgence of talk about rebuilding the Teton Dam, and obviously would build it with much greater safety, you know, expectations. What are your thoughts as a dam safety engineer? You'd be the guy that you'd charge a lot of money consulting the rest of us, saying whether it should be built or not. And I think a lot of people would be interested in your opinion on that.
Yeah. So as a dam safety engineer, my job is to make it safe. And if you were to rebuild at Teton Dam, people always ask, can you build a safe dam there? And the answer is absolutely. Ryrie Dam, which was built around the same time on very similar geology, is still standing today. And in fact, the guy who went back to Congress and asked for extra money for grouting to deal with the issues at Ryrie that they didn't deal with at Teton. So could we do it? Absolutely. We can build a safe dam there. We can't build a cheap safe dam there.
Yeah.
It's going to be very expensive to deal with the geology correctly. And so then you just have to look at, is it worth the cost to do it? You know, is it make good sense? And that gets down to how big is the benefit from building it. And that's the part I'm not the expert at. I don't know the numbers. I don't know how much the value of water is up here. I know it's needed.
Yeah.
I just don't know enough to say, is it worth the cost?
Yeah.
Is there a better location that you're aware of than that location that already failed?
They looked at several locations during that. You're dealing with similar geology. And as you push it further up, you also, some of the geology improves a little bit, but then your benefit goes down. Right. So it's kind of this scaling factor that you look at. And that's really where they ended up putting it where they did, is it gave them good benefit because you're near the end of that canyon. Right. You're not too much further down. So you have the benefits, yet the geology is pretty similar along there.
So, I mean, if you were to rebuild a dam there, and I do want to get back to kind of the history because we're remembering 50 years ago today, but if you rebuilt that dam, would you want to rebuild more of a kind of a vertical concrete dam? I don't know the right names for these, but like the Hungry Horse Dam, I've been to that, and others that are, they're very vertical, they're kind of curved in holding the water back. Or could you build a safe earthen dam if you were to do the other things correctly?
Yeah, the earthen dam could be built safely. And that, the reason they chose an earthen dam is because of the material that's here, that it brings down the cost. So you could build it. It's all about the foundation. Do you treat the foundation enough? Can you afford to grout it completely, which they determined they couldn't, or remove the really bad material up the abutments? And so you could. Concrete dam's an option. People have talked about a rock fill dam. Rock fill dams allow for a lot more seepage, but you're going to get a lot more protection. You can do a good filtered rock fill dam. There's options to build a lot of dams.
Yeah.
But no matter what dam you build, you have to put it on a good foundation.
Yeah, I gotcha. Okay, well, let's take another break, and we'll come back and continue. I know we can rebuild it from an engineering standpoint, but politically, can we rebuild it? And we'd ask you about that on the other side, right here on News Talk 107.9. The title of the book is Failure and Fortitude, How Faith, Politics, and Power Shaped the Teton Dam Disaster. The author is Nathaniel Gee, PhD, and he is our guest today on this 50th anniversary of the Teton Dam failure. What a sad story, but a fascinating story and a lot to learn from it. And as we left the last break, I want to pose that question to you. As a dam safety engineer, and you have seen, I don't know how many dams, and you understand how they work, we could safely rebuild the Teton Dam. But politically, do you think it's achievable to be able to do it?
Yeah. Well, for like you mentioned, after Teton, we see this shrinking of building dams. Very few dams were built from essentially 1980. There's a few they continued on all the way till about 2010. Well, recently, dams have started to be built again in this country. More so. In fact, in college, I went to take a dam building class, and my teacher pulled me aside and said, "You plan to stay in the United States, right?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "We teach that class for foreign students. No one's ever going to build a dam in the United States again." And I really wish I would have had the class. You know, I've had to learn a lot of it outside of that. But we have been building dams again, mostly offline storage dams, mostly large reservoirs that we're doing pump generation at. There's been one on Salt River they've looked at. We're exploring one in the Tennessee Valley. There's been some in California. So dams are being built. So could it be done? Yes, I think politically there are chances. I mean, I know there's a lot of popularity locally for it. So I think there's chances. I don't think it's impossible. Not easy.
Yeah. Gotcha.
All right, let's get back to the story of the flood. Where we left off talking about dam safety was the dam breaks. And I know you've interviewed so many people and included those stories into the book. So share the most important ones. You're a great storyteller. Just tell us what happened after the dam broke.
There's so many amazing stories. And one of the first things, actually the first paper I ever wrote was looking at those who perished during the flood. Because you always hear 11 lives lost, and I could find the 11 names. But here I was studying dams and looking at all over the country. I was looking at, hey, if this dam fails, who dies? How many die? Where are they? I'm doing modeling, looking at it. What is the risk to the public? And I said, we have this real event. Who were they? Where were they? And so I decided to dive into that. And one of the ones that really interested me was the very first one. And that is 9:30 in the morning, Saturday morning, Daryl Griggs gets up in St. Anthony and decides he's going to go fishing. What's interesting about that, he says it's 9:30 in the morning. Back at the site at that very moment, the project construction engineer's on the phone with the regional director saying, we've got an issue here at the Teton Dam. And they talk about what they can do. And as he goes to hang up the call, he says, do you think I should go ahead and warn the public? And the regional director says, well, do you think you can get under control? Yeah, I think so. Well, then we don't want to cause a panic. So he decides not to make an official warning at that time, just as Daryl's leaving his house. He drives down through St. Anthony, through the town of Wilford, goes to Teton, where he has breakfast and meets up with his friend David Benson. They eat breakfast till about 10:30. It's right around 10:45 that up back at the site, things have deteriorated so much that he says, I can't wait any longer. He tells the sheriffs to go ahead and evacuate people downstream. One of the first places the sheriff goes is to the town of Teton, about 10 to 15 minutes too late, as the boys have left and gone down to their fishing spot. They're down there fishing. A plane starts swooping overhead. They see someone waving at them. They think, who's waving at me from this plane? So they wave back.
Yeah.
And then they start to see the water rising, muddy discharge. And they say, man, those idiots at the new dam are letting go too much water. What's going on? And then they turn and see a 30-foot wall of water coming their way. Daryl jumps into it, trying to get out of it. He says he can't even get to the surface for a long time, fears he's going to drown. Eventually gets a hold of a tree, kind of pulls himself up, and is able to keep himself above the water. Unfortunately, that tree hits a bunch of other trees and starts to press on him. He has a break several ribs, collapses a lung before that breaks free. And then he's eventually found passed out. He comes in and out of consciousness and is found in a cottonwood tree that he kind of scrambles up into later that day, about 5 or 6 that afternoon. Mm. David Benson is the first fatality. He did not survive. He was found about a quarter mile upstream from, or further north, not upstream, but further north from where they found Daryl Griggs. So he's the first life loss of Teton Dam. And, you know, the whole time while I was going up there, you just see the slow deterioration. And it is too bad that they didn't decide to warn sooner. But the amazing thing is, even as late as they decide to warn, how quickly the word got out. There are so many miracles that lined up to reduce the life loss at Teton Dam. I do models all over the country about how dams fail. We've done models looking at Teton to revisit it. No model shows the kind of evacuation you get at Teton, where you only have 11 lives lost when you have 25,000 people displaced this close to the dam. And the reason for that is so many. One, Saturday afternoon. You know, Saturday right at noon is perfect timing. It's a sunny day. Dams don't always fail in sunny days. It's often raining and there's a lot of bad things going on. It's sunny. It's nice out. People can get out. And the other thing was just community. People knew who their neighbors were. And they heard from their aunt and they heard from their next door neighbor and they heard from their home teacher. And they, you know, and about the fourth or fifth time, they start to say, oh, maybe I do need to get out of here, you know, and they do get out. And so that is a really important part of the dam and this evacuation. And people rightfully so make a big deal about Ricks College, right? Ricks College is somewhere people knew about. They knew how to get there. It ended up being safe. It's surprising how close the water gets to Ricks College. You know, if you look at those pictures, it gets right up to Ricks College. But Ricks College is safe.
Because for people who don't know, it's up on the hill.
Yeah.
So it's elevated in the city of Rexburg, which is why it was able to dodge the water.
Yep, absolutely. And another just incredible thing that I think can't be overstated enough is you have that morning 25,000 people who would not have a place to stay that night. They have to find a different house to stay at. And we always say, well, it was a good thing the college wasn't in classes, right? There's housing for people. Well, that's about 2,500. That's about 10% of the people who needed housing.
Yeah.
What about the other 90%? And that's friends, relatives, and strangers. People showing up at the St. Anthony Stake Center and turning their house of four into a house of 24 overnight as they're housing people. So just people opening up their homes was incredible.
Nathaniel, what about the weeks after? I mean, how long did it take for the water to finally recede and then for the recovery to happen? Because a lot of people's homes and businesses and other infrastructure was destroyed. So what was it like in the, say, the 6 or 8 weeks after the flood?
So there's a lot of things that organize and what they have to do to get that moving. One of my favorite stories is Don Ellis. Radio, you guys in radio probably know Don Ellis, right? He was there, and people make a big deal that he was on site telling people, hey, this is failing. You need to get out. This is a ton of water. This is more than you've ever seen. As the other station had the beep, this is not a drill, you know. So much important. So many people say, I got out because they heard Don Ellis. But his radio station becomes important in that longer recovery. His radio station gets destroyed. And he gets a call from the governor who says, when are you coming back on the air? And he says, I don't know. It could be months. You know, I don't have any of my equipment. I don't even have a radio station. I don't know what I would do. And the governor says, we're going to get you on in the next week. And he gets the National Guard and they fly in material and they get his radio station going again. And it becomes the radio station of the recovery. They're doing radio programs telling people, what is the claim process going to be like? How do you file claims? What do you do? Who do you let know about the, how do you get volunteers to your home? All these different things. And then the church organization became really important as well, because the church started gathering every day. The stake presidents and bishops started getting together and saying, okay, who needs a home, right? We know the Julians are up in Salt Lake and they have a home for the next 3 to 4 months. So we don't need to muck out their home quite yet. But this person is living in this home of 25 people. We got to get them out. Is their home close enough to livable that if we get some volunteers over there, we can get them in sooner? And they're organizing all these moving pieces of what volunteers are coming in, buses from all over the West, and which homes make the most sense, and how can we get them in the soonest? And then you have, in addition to that, the actual federal piece, which is they do quickly appropriate money to pay for actual losses. And the claims are two bills pass of $200 million each. So it's $400 million that gets appropriated for claims. Got to interview some of the people who took claims. They said it was hard to get people to give their claims. He told me about meeting with a farmer said, you lost everything. We've got to put something on this claim form. And he just kept saying, all I want is my horse. You know, I just want my horse back. And he said, well, you lost a whole barn of stuff. What was in that barn? He said, oh, I don't know. You know, and he said, well, you had to have some nails, right? He said, sure, I had nails. And, you know, he'd try to get him to slowly put in things. He says he'll never forget. He went and visited him about 3 weeks after the failure. And the guy was just so happy. And he said, what? He said, my horse came back. And so he said that was throughout. They were worried. So they set it up very worried about fraud.
Yeah.
They were worried, hey, we can't have more than one claim set for one person because they'll come back. And they found so quickly there was just no fraud. It was so little that that was not their worry. The worry was the opposite. You know, are we going to get people to take the claims that they need? And in the end, you know, it was estimated over $1 billion of damage in that dollars of that day. And the final claims came in at $322 million.
Wow.
What a testament of the people.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the interesting claims that was denied was a $71 million claim from the Madison-Fremont Irrigation District. They say, federal government, you committed to build us a dam. Where's our dam? So they put in a $71 million claim to rebuild Teton Dam. That one was denied.
Claim denied.
Right.
Well,
is there anything that we've missed that, I mean, we're getting close on time. What is there something else you would like to chat about with this commemoration?
Yeah, I just think you always look back and say, what can we learn from Teton? And it is so amazing, the community that was there, right? And I think I look and say, what community am I building today, right? There's a moment, no matter, Teton is not the last disaster that we're going to have in this country. And there's been many more, and there'll be many more. But there's a moment between when the disaster occurs and when help shows up from outside. You don't know if that's going to be a day. You don't know if that's going to be a week. You don't know if that's going to be a month. We all hope for a good government that's responsive, but we don't know. And during that time, it's just you and your community. And have we built the community that's prepared to deal with that time? They were here, you know.
Our guest today, Nathaniel Gee, his book is Failure and Fortitude, How Faith, Politics, and Power Shaped the Teton Dam Disaster. Nathaniel, I know Julie agrees with me. It's been a pleasure to have you in today. Yeah. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah.
We'll be back. We'll wrap up the hour after this on News Talk 107.9.